Welcome to The Composter, a podcast for farmers and composters. I'm your host and fellow composter, Jane Murner Senecal. Join me in practical conversation between industry professionals and farmers with a passion for producing high-quality compost. We are going to dig deep into the science, technology, and art of compost production so that we as composters can help enliven the world's soils. In today's episode, I had the absolute pleasure to talk to Nora Goldstein. No one has a better pulse on the movement of the organics recycling industry than Nora. She is the editor and heart of BioCycle, the organics recycling authority. BioCycle is where I turn for current news on composting. Nora's father, Jerry Goldstein, started BioCycle in 1960, back when it was called Compost Science. Nora has taken her deep love of composting and turned it into a useful resource for all composters to learn more and help each other. I am tickled to get to interview her today. Today's episode of The Composter is brought to you by BioCycle. Founded in 1960, BioCycle is the go-to resource on composting, organics recycling, anaerobic digestion and biogas, end product markets, policies and regulations, and community outreach and education. It's where I go to keep up with composting news. I have learned a tremendous amount by signing up for the BioCycle Connect, the twice-monthly free e-newsletter on BioCycle's website, biocycle.net. I highly recommend checking it out. This episode is also brought to you by ComTech. Today, more than ever, people are discovering the benefits of compost in gardens, landscapes, and agriculture. However, as composting awareness grows, so does consumer demand. As a result, commercial composters are seeking ways to increase year-round production while maintaining high levels of quality in their compost. For many, the solution is a better process. For over 25 years, ComTech has worked with scientists, agriculture experts, and customers to develop a four-step process that produces healthy, contaminant-free compost while optimizing commercial production efficiency. This process is known as shred, turn, screen, and separate. You can learn more about the ComTech process at comtechamericas.com/composterpodcast. And ComTech is with a K. While you're there, request a complimentary consultation to discover if the ComTech process is right for your commercial operation. On our farm, Earthcare Farm, screening used to be the bottleneck in our process. We now have a ComTech M2 Multistar screener, and it has made our composting process much more efficient. ComTech America is proud to support the Composter podcast and is ready to help you make the most of a great opportunity. And now, back to the show. Good morning, Nora. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you for having me.
Nora, you've seen and talked with so many composters. What are the trends that you're seeing in the industry now?
So I think one of the more important trends, because it opens the door to more both nonprofit and private sector individuals to get involved, is really decentralized composting is being more baked into the composting infrastructure in the country. It's baked in the sense that an increasing number of states are creating a regulatory tier, oftentimes exemptions if you're under a certain size square footage or a certain amount of material. And that really reduces the barriers to entry. Mm. And the other piece of that is just because you're small doesn't mean you, you don't have to pay attention to really good composting protocols. And so with that are either requirements or guidance on really how to manage a composting facility in terms of reaching proper temperatures and aeration and odor management and all the different things that go with it. So I think, that is important, and that does include on-farm composting mm-hmm. infrastructure. And so I just find that encouraging because for many decades, you know, the trend has been you build more centralized industrial scale facilities, and that really benefits the economies of scale. And not to say it doesn't, but it also precludes individuals from getting more involved. And in many cases, these decentralized sites are very much integrated into local food systems or into neighborhood revitalization or job training. So there's food access, you know, so there's those elements that are so important, you know, to how we have to connect things. And then the other couple of other things, I think it's harder and harder to procure clean sources of organics. And I'm talking in this regard primarily of source separated food waste or food scraps, depending on how you like to call them. Because so much of, you know, there's not that many states, maybe 10 now, that have some sort of a ban on landfill disposal of certain, primarily food waste streams. Many states have had bans on yard waste for a lot of years. And so there's some incentives or requirements to divert and to service, and these are primarily commercial food waste generators, to service them, you have to be more, maybe possibly more accommodating of the ability to take organics that aren't cleanly separated from certain generator sectors. Mm-hmm. You know, like institutions and restaurants and residential. So it's, we're just seeing this trend where you really do need to work harder to get clean sources of organics without accepting much contamination. We're seeing more acquisitions. There's not very many companies doing the acquiring, but those that are in that business, you've got WeCare or Denali Water Solutions is one. Another is Atlas Organics, which was acquired by a venture firm called Generate Capital. And a few other players are really seeing access to the footprint that a composter has and the municipal contracts and other things as you know, being a valuable investment. And then that with that goes investment interest. So we are seeing a little more equity capital looking at the composting space. And the last trend, and I think this is really important to the audience that we're, you know, addressing in terms of sort of the connection between compost and agriculture, is the lack of recognition of compost as integral to regenerative agriculture. It is just not part of the vernacular in any structural way at this time. And by that, I mean the focus when you get people buying into regenerative, it's cover crops and no-till, which are good practices, soil conservation practices, adding, you know, keeping, cycling, you know, the cover crops. But you really do need the introduction of soil organic matter, and that comes from utilization of compost. And one thing I want to say is that there's a public comment period open just until June 16th. It's a new conservation practice. It was adopted on an interim basis in about 10 states, and now they're looking to bake it into the Natural Resources Conservation Standard, where there's recognition of compost and biochar as agricultural inputs that are eligible for financing, you know, through USDA or NRCS. So your listeners can go either to the U.S. Composting Council's advocacy page and be able to access form letter that you can customize. We also did a piece on it in BioCycle. So those are just some of the top of mind trends that we're seeing right now in the industry.
Excellent. I kind of want to break those down a little bit. I'm particularly excited about the first one you mentioned, more decentralized compost facilities and reduced barriers for getting in to composting. I know in our state we have, you can either be a composter, which is sort of the more through the waste management side of our DEM, or you can be an agricultural composter, which does have less barriers if you have a farm and you're producing for your farm and selling, you know, some off of your farm. And that's really encouraging for, I think, our audience that's kind of growing more the smaller ways to get in, because it can be really daunting when you first look at the rules and regulations. Sometimes I've seen people just kind of be like, oh, it's too much. Maybe we'll do something else. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. And especially if it's not your main business, you know, where in the case of farms, they are really looking, there's a need for physical sites for municipalities and some organics haulers to be able to utilize, let me reverse that. It's more of like there's really not in many areas enough infrastructure to manage the organics that have been recognized as being important to get out of the waste stream due to either their contributions to climate, you know, to generation of methane being one primary one. And another driver is really how you can rebuild soils and make them healthy so that you can bring back local food systems and urban ag and community farms. And you can't do that if you don't have compost because it's the, you know, and so even if you're looking, state of Ohio has a community composting permit or exemption that's 500 square feet. So you can imagine a little community garden being able to accommodate 500 square feet to accept food scraps from the neighborhood or a couple of small restaurants in the area. And then they use that compost to help rebuild the soil. And so it just opens doors. And I think what's important, some states do have exemptions. In this case, we'll use the example of farms, but they're not necessarily, they were maybe adopted, you know, not recently, and so don't quite incorporate some of the flexibility in terms of what you can allow farms to do, as long as there is guidance and oversight and performance-based criteria, like you can't pollute your water, you can't stink, you know. And so a case in point, I was on a conversation the other day in the state of Maryland. They have an on-farm exemption, but it's a bit onerous. It doesn't necessarily incentivize farms to get involved. And so that too is important wherever you are to, if your state has an on-farm composting exemption, is just to see if it's the degree of flexibility. And if it doesn't, to make sure that it accommodates a certain scale or the ability to take inputs from off the farm, which is one criteria in some states. It has to be what you generate on your farm.
Mm. Yeah, that can be challenging if you don't have enough carbon sources on your farm, or, you know, you only have cattle, or you only have corn, or something like that.
So, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that's where you can work with, taking in leaves or, you know, some other trimmings and have some bulking agent amendment, you know, your carbon source.
Yeah. I like that idea of having just a whole, like a food web of different size compost sites around to kind of all support each other in a way.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm definitely, I mean, we're feeling it here at our farm, that the part you mentioned about it's harder to get clean sources of materials just as our world is more and more just contaminated with plastics and things. Even in wood chips, sometimes I'm finding, you know, bits of plastic in those fabric covers that people use to suppress weeds. And it's harder than it was even just 10 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And then I guess that flip side, all the acquisitions is sort of the opposite of those more community decentralized compost facilities. We're kind of getting the two things at once, the larger.
Exactly. And, you know, it's interesting because some of the acquisitions, I'm just trying to think of the latest. I read a press release on a company called Atlas Organics, and they bought primarily a yard trimmings wood waste composting site in one of the Gulf towns, Sarasota, Tampa area, Florida. And this particular company, Atlas Organics, has really done great work in market development for end products. So what they can bring to the acquisition is upgrading and updating the equipment on site, consistency and output, building markets, and then taking in new waste streams. And so it does bring capability. The other thing we're seeing, like this company, Atlas Organics, has public-private partnerships with jurisdictions. So they essentially get a contract to manage the organics and then utilize the city's or county's facility. And then the investment comes in upgrading the equipment that is at the cost of the private sector. But they have totally not had to go down the route of finding a new site, permitting a new site, preparing a new site, you know.
Sort of a public-private.
Exactly.
You know, something together. I've seen a lot of poorly run municipal compost facilities, so that might not be a bad idea to utilize those.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So it's a way to bring more services and infrastructure where the private sector brings in the capital and the public sector, you know, says we're going to bring you our food waste or yard trimmings. And we're signing a 10-year contract at this price or price with escalator, you know, so that's, I'm not speaking that, but that's kind of the way the public privates get developed.
Okay. That's a really interesting trend for sure. Do you think we need more high quality compost producers?
My answer in short is yes, absolutely. Because all the beautiful things that compost can do to the soil and bring to the soil, you don't want to be introducing either immature composts that haven't, you know, been properly cured, so they're still a little bit green, and composts that do still contain bits of plastic or other contaminants. And I think part of the challenge is the way the system is set up. And you and I spoke about this a couple of years ago when we had a feature article on Earth Care Farms, is we need somehow to create more demand for the quality compost because it brings a higher revenue, you know, dollar value to the producer, to the compost manufacturer, because it's helping the growers, you know, with their soil practices and also their nutrient fertilization practices. And right now, so many composting facilities are built where they're earning their revenue primarily from the tipping fees and less from the sales, the product sales. Mm-hmm. And so I think the amount, you know, it's 70, the average is 70% tip fees, 30% sales, and a company, you know, like Earth Care Farms is the flip. And so the you are getting rewarded for the high quality compost you produce. So I think we just need this recognition, again, as a really valuable regenerative ag input. And then I think if there's less pressure on the tip fee, then in going backwards to the generator, maybe you incentivize really clean materials by having a reduced tipping fee. And you're not, it's not a smoke and mirrors thing. Like, yeah, we'll only charge you this and then go off and, you know, the material goes somewhere, sometimes to feed, sometimes to compost. You know, but it's really, we want and need your clean organics, and therefore we're going to incentivize it because we have this really strong market demand on the other end.
Is that the same way that you recognize a high quality composter, by those sales, or is it there's something, is there, are there other things that you notice?
I think that's, so to me, that's sort of more the market incentive that I just described and sort of the revenue structure. But I think high quality compost producers also recognize the importance of not pushing material through in a really quick turnaround to open up space on their composting pad, but where there's recognition that the, you know, the more the material cures, you're getting repopulation of very beneficial bacteria and fungi, and that's where you tend to get your disease suppression. When, you know, so you can, you, so I think where composters can and do take the time to have that patience. And then I think the other thing really is education about what is high quality compost. I think there's, you know, there's a baseline that is established with the U.S. Composting Council's seal of testing assurance, you know, where we see some departments of transportation when they're using compost for slope stabilization, stormwater management, where they'll say it has to be a STA approved or certified compost, right? So that sets a bar, which is very important. And I think the more customer education about what a good high quality compost does and is is important to sort of build that rigor back into the production. All this is to say, you can have, you know, material, as long as it's not contaminated and it goes through quickly, as long as it's going to applications that don't require a fully mature compost, or if you're doing a soil blend, and this is more your expertise versus mine, but, you know, where, yes, you can, you don't have to do all of those things I just outlined, but I think it's a sort of a mindset. And creating that market value.
I feel like this audience is a lot of growers, and I think they make the best composters because they know what they want at the end. You know, I'm coming in from that farm background, and I know what I want it to look like and perform like. So it's just working backwards to get to that point. So really helpful.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Hey, you all, Farmer Jesse here. The goal of No-Till Growers is to help produce and create valuable niche content like what you're listening to now. We create several different podcasts, from the Winter Growers podcast hosted by Clara Coleman to the Collaborative Farming podcast with host Jackson Rolette and many more. We produce videos at the No-Till Growers YouTube channel, including farm tours and crop-specific breakdowns. And our entire model is to create helpful, valuable farming content that is free and open to the public, so anyone, anywhere can use it. So if you appreciate that and our work, or are simply enjoying this show, please consider signing up to be a patron at patreon.com/no-till growers. There are also other support options at no-till growers.com, or you can even purchase a copy of my book, The Living Soil Handbook, because when you purchase it directly from no-till growers.com specifically, the proceeds go to making you more amazing content like this. Okay, that's my spiel. Thanks, you all. Back to the show.
So you've seen a lot of compost facilities start up and a lot, unfortunately, go out of business. But do you see trends in the ones that do stick around?
Yeah, I think so much of it is where is this? I'm just looking because I did make a few notes here. Yeah. But when you physically go to visit a composting site and you see like litter fences that are just coated with litter, you see ruts. If it's not a paved surface, you see ruts that are accumulating liquid, leachate primarily. You see cross-contamination of using the same bucket loader. You turn your pot, you mix an active pile, and you go over and scoop up a load of finished compost. So much of it is well-defined materials handling and operating procedures. And this is especially important if you're taking food waste as part of your mix, because that requires, as you well know, a higher level of management versus if you're getting in loads of leaves or wood chips or even some bedding, that isn't super high in nitrogen. And so it's really those procedures and making sure, you know, that one thing that we see a lot of composters doing this day is they build an active pile and then they'll put a biofilter layer on the top, like a 10-inch layer or 12-inch of finished compost or mulch to really help, you know, that first stage of composting when things can generate more odors. So I think that is, you know, just checking with your eyes and knowing what you want to look for. Other things, and I did a big review of different states' composting regulations last year, and many states are requiring, as part of the permitting process, that the operator to be trained or certified. And I think it's very important to, even if you think you know what you're doing, to go to and take a training, whether online or in person. USCC has a certified compost operator program. So, you know, it just kind of puts you through some rigor. So I think that is a good baseline. The thing that I'm a big stickler for and have been, and we've seen facilities go down the drain when they don't follow this, is really good relationships with their neighbors and their regulators. And, you know, for a long time, this many facilities, you know, they got cited, went through the permitting process. Maybe they didn't have to go through public hearings. Maybe they had to get some local permissions. And then, so they're under the radar and neighbors don't know they're there until, you know, either they drive by and they smell with their eyes or they actually smell and they're being impacted, you know, by odors. And so the more you can fly above the radar, and I think you have a whole protocol with your neighbors, you know, to build those positive relationships and to use them as your alerts, if you will. If they're detecting an odor, you know, they need to let you know so that you can go, because it may have gone off site before you detected it. So really, really important. And it's worth every penny. We used to say for cities that were issuing requests for proposals, you know, you put in a budget line item for relationship building and outreach and education. And in some cases, that also includes the regulators. And then my last thing I just think is where you have happy end users. Because if you have happy compost users, you get all that wonderful word of mouth benefits and means you're doing it right.
Yeah, yeah. We're just about to have our neighborhood and employee farm party. That's one thing we do every year. We're just a big bonfire and we have food and gather and celebrate our neighbors putting up with. There's more truck traffic and
yes,
even the best management practices, you can't predict 9 days of rain and there'll be some kind of odor. You know, there's just, it's hard to get it 100% right every day when you're working with nature.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, the kind of gets into, you know, which ones are able to last to long enough is to have a, and you know this better than I do, but you have to have a humble relationship with the microbes and the biology. Mm-hmm. We published a book back in the 80s, I think it was, called The Art and Science of Composting, because you can follow all the protocols, all the science of, you know, there has to be enough, the right moisture and CN ratio and airflow and all that. But as you just said, you can get into situations where you can't control it because of 9 days of rain, right?
Yeah.
But you really have to respect the biology. And if you don't, the biology will literally bite you. Mm-hmm. Because and how to optimize it, you know, so it's a little bit of animal husbandry in a funny way.
It is. So it's like you're running a microbe zoo.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think, you know, I got my training back in the late 70s from a gentleman named Clarence Skolick. He was at the University of California, Berkeley Sanitation Lab, but he and my father together were instrumental in starting compost science. And one of the things that Clarence said to me early on is, you know, I think it was, you know, for many decades, a lot of companies were advertising these magic inoculants that would just make your compost go faster. And he's like, it's really the microbiology. So if you put this material in, this inoculant, so you maybe reach temperatures 12 hours earlier than you would have by just making sure the biology, you know, the microbes have the environment they need to thrive. And so that's really where the ethic of that respect of that relationship. And I think where composters cut corners, either, you know, for a host of reasons, it's where you run into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Huh. All right. So I know this community of composters in particular is really concerned about persistent herbicides and PFAS. And there's a lot of ways to, you know, prevent those from getting into our system, but they're not always foolproof. And is there talk of any legislation or other ways to get these chemicals off the market? And how do you see, like, other composters around the country keeping these materials out of their compost?
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's, they're pervasive. Like, I'll talk first about the polyfluorinated compounds or PFAS, you know, that are sort of the general category that are ubiquitous. They're in consumer products. They're in, you know, pizza boxes and ski wax, and, you know, because they do bring that combination of lipophobic and hydrophobic. So, you know, it'll capture and prevent grease from coming through the pizza box as you're driving it home, you know. Mm-hmm. And it'll keep your couch from catching on fire if you drop a match. Mm-hmm. You know, and so there's this level of exposure, even just within our day-to-day lives. And then you have the legacy with the firefighting foam, for example, military bases. In my community, we got a letter from the borough that our water, they detected higher levels of PFAS in our water. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it, not to be concerned, but, you know, and this is how they're addressing it. And there's very expensive technologies to deal with it. But so I think where the state of the knowledge is in terms of what do we really know about, you know, the effects of PFAS on humans, on the environment, you know, it's still a very new science. And the sad part about the whole thing is it's people who are trying to do a good thing with the organic in our little world with the organics are the ones that ultimately pay the price for causing the pollution, right? And you know, 30, 40 years ago, we may not have known the impacts of land application of paper mill sludge. Mm-hmm. It helped. Farmers liked it. That land application of municipal biosolids. And so BioCycle has done a number of articles on this. And what the conclusion is among folks like myself and those who I really learn from in the community is until we really work towards bans where you just can't make these chemicals anymore. And one thing we saw, and I'm not proficient enough in it to say more than the following, is there was a transition from long chain compounds of polyfluorinated compounds to shorter chains, which were supposedly beneficial. And, you know, now, however many years later, it's still having the same kind of impacts. And again, that's a very general statement because I am one of those people who knows a little, just enough to be dangerous with some topics. But I really do believe that just there are so many states looking at extended producer responsibility laws, and they tend to focus on packaging that ends up in the recycling stream. And they really have to step up what we call EPR laws for these kinds of compounds, similar to the persistent herbicides, because those who feel the impact are not the ones that benefit from their use. And I also advocate, you know, we're really, like I said, we're on the tip of, you know, we have not yet reached a state of the knowledge on this. Mm-hmm. And so you have situations where you're going to ban the use of any organics, like just recycled organics, with biosolids, like in Maine, which is understandable from sort of what the current state of knowledge is. But if those practices are happening and now those materials are going to end up in a landfill, well, there's PFAS and leachate of landfills, right? So yeah, you just got to be careful as you legislate to be, you know, this is maybe what we need for now, but we really all have to commit to solutions, which could include bans. And then just to jump to persistent herbicides, I mean, that reared its head in 1999 out in Washington state. And it was, you know, I don't remember if it was clopyrrolid was the particular chemical, but used in, you know, on hay fields for weed control. And the persistent herbicides were looked as better herbicides than what, you know, they replaced, which maybe did more leaching or had, you know, didn't work as quickly. So you had to put on more. So for those using chemical herbicides, this was a blessing. You just have to put it on and boom. But what nobody took into consideration is that weed suppressive effect, if it gets through an entire compost cycle into the compost and then used on people's gardens, you're going to kill their tomato plants. Mm-hmm. And that's what started happening in Washington state, and then closer in New England to Green Mountain compost up in Burlington, you know, not Burlington, Vermont, but I'm blanking on the town they're in right next to it. But, you know, they really got socked and they traced it in that case to horse bedding. And so there was all this pushback to the different, what do you call them, chemical or plant food control officials, whoever regulates in the states the pesticides and herbicides, to do labeling on the, you know, on the containers where you, these are states you can use it and can't, and chains of custody and all this stuff. How well that has been adopted, because now it's 10 years ago, mm-hmm. like since the Green Mountain thing. Is it still on radar? I know U.S. Composting Council and others met with EPA, you know, their pesticide approval people to try to address this. The U.S. Composting Council, I think, or their Compost Research Education Foundation has an ongoing advocacy group around this, that it's important, you know, make sure you're part of that if this is something of interest.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something that keeps me up at night for sure, thinking about, you know, bedding should be something that is a welcome input here on the farm for making compost. And it's something I'm so hesitant to take in. Any hay and bedding is always a kind of a scary thing, hearing the stories of other composters that thought they were taking in things that were clean and ruined huge batches of compost and ruined their name, you know, so quickly.
Oh, absolutely. And so, you know, one of the things I'd recommend 10 years out from where, you know, this all sort of people were trying to do things either legislatively or within the regulatory frameworks, is labeling. And like I said, chains of custody is where is that now? You know, like, is that still going on? Where did some of these plant food control officials land on this? And a couple of people, again, I'd recommend touching base with the U.S. Composting Council. I just don't remember if it's within the council or their foundation. But there's an active group that stays on top of this. You know, so, yeah, I don't know whether you post when you post the podcast, if there are resources, but I can find out where to go to find that.
Excellent. That's actually my next question, is what resources do you recommend? So we'll make sure that we post those when we do put this up.
Absolutely.
Are there other resources beyond, you know, U.S. Compost Council and those links that you're going to provide?
Sure. So I recommend people go to the BioCycle Archives. They date back to 2004, and you can find just about anything. We've probably written about it. Mm-hmm. And so never hurts to take a search through there, or do it a search via Google. Sometimes their Google search is better than our own search, which I think is built somewhere around Google. So definitely do that. The other is Cornell Waste Management Institute has just a ton of composting resources on its website. NRCS, and you know, definitely has especially now with all. I'm going to contradict myself because I'm not sure how much NRCS website talks about compost use, but there are, you know, different state land grant cooperative extensions have done reports on manure composting, for example. And then brand new, just came out the last couple months, is the Composting Handbook, which is so heavy and so big.
But I have a copy. It's so good.
It was an update of one that Bob Rink put together 25 years ago or more. And it really has expanded. So I think it's a very worthwhile investment. And I think the Compost Research Education Foundation may even offer a discount if you're a member. And then the other thing I just want to recommend is taking advantage of compost operator trainings. They come in different degrees of sophistication, but I think it's always good to get with either in person or virtually with your colleague composters. And it just is an opportunity to learn from each other. So to whatever extent, you can do that, whether it's organized by your state, or through, you know, nonprofits. I think, and the Institute for Local Self-Reliance for the distributed composting has excellent resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excellent. That's great. Is there anything else you wish I'd asked or just want to talk about to this audience of composters, your audience?
Yeah, I think we've covered so much of it, but, you know, I want to say after I'm going on 45 years in doing this for a living, and once you get bitten by the compost bug, a happy bug, good bug, you know, and you start to develop that, see just the whole biological process of taking raw materials and ending up with a compost and then using the compost and blends made with compost and seeing the impacts, is it's really, and I'm going to sound silly, but it is amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's inspiring. And so one thing I just have never been able to shake, nor have many of my colleagues and composting friends, is, you know, once you've been bitten by the bug, it, you know, you're in, because it is a powerful tool. And I think it's gotten a little more complicated and complex because, you know, of the number and types of feedstocks and contamination. But truly, you know, it is a very powerful tool. Mm-hmm. And in this day and age where we're trying, you know, soil health is so depleted, it's like, why are we throwing away 1 ounce of an organic waste? Mm-hmm. Other if it's highly contaminated, but, you know, we need every drop. And so how we get policy-wise, practice-wise, investment-wise to really doing this and not get so tied up in knots. And this is really where the good practice stuff is important, where you really need to be working through regulations and guidance that are performance-based, right? Mm-hmm. So you shall not generate odors. You shall not pollute the groundwater. You shall not pollute the surface water. You shall, you know, and don't say how you're going to do that, but those are your requirements and your operating parameters. And that also lowers the barrier to entry, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's important. And then I did have one last parting thought, which went out of my head. Yeah, went out of my head. But I do think this is a great time and a good opportunity. It's now probably more than ever, I'd say in many states, they're more receptive to looking at their policies and regulations and reconsidering that, and also to whatever extent possible, this is another thing I preach, is make to the extent possible your biggest allies and integrators are your local food system. And, you know, when I say local, that can be, doesn't have to be micro local or hyper local, but you're all on the same, all pulling for each other. And you're integral to each other, and a lot of interest in local food systems and working with schools and institutions and small farmers, and just be, you know, embellish it, encourage it, nurture it, nourish it and nurture it. They're my final words.
Beautiful. Well, thank you. You're very humble for your 45 years of extensive experience in this industry. And you've just brought so many things to light today. I appreciate you so much.
Oh, you are so welcome. And what makes BioCycle, and this, my father, was totally ingrained in us, is we really learn from your stories and what we have done over 63 years now, is tell your stories, listen, learn, tell, and keep doing it because you can learn more. So you never know it all.
And it's true. It's exciting.
It's people like you who are doing it that are the best teachers for myself and all those who listen.
Forever humble. I appreciate you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate you as well. And thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you so much. If you enjoyed hearing from Nora Goldstein as much as I did, make sure to check out biocycle.net. This podcast was produced with the help from No-Till Growers. A massive thank you to Jackson Rowlett for his many podcasting skills, Farmer Jesse for his encouragement, and Michael Sellers for his editing wizardry. If you are like me and can't help bobbing your head when you hear that musical intro, check out soulshot.net. And thank you so much for all of you compost-loving listeners.